Okay, I'm just going to review a little bit of what Punk has talked about, then go on explain the general exploits you're seeing about every other day on bug tracks. If you're a security expert, I'm going to bore you to death. This is newbie track that I arranged. The purpose of this newbie track is so you don't have to ask stupid questions. We'll answer them for you. What I'll basically cover here is what's TCP/IP, why do we need it, basically what are ports and sockets, known problems, and basically general attack methods. If you're awake during the last hour, you already know this, what TCP is, set of protocols, ARPANET basically became the internet, all that fun stuff. And I'm going to skip over the first several slides, obviously, since it's kind of redundant from Pungus's talk. We have basically your... I'm stupid enough to try to call me during my talk. basically, if you use the internet, you use TCP/IP. That's just the way life is. What is IP? It's basically a collection of protocols that compromise a suite. This is, in fact, well, you're at the last talk. What am I talking about? Skip this stuff. You know? You know? Okay, that's the ISO stack. I'm going to raise this up here. You should actually know the ISO stack. I think it's full of bullshit. You know, it reminds me of a seven-layer burrito. But, in fact, layer one is your, you know, layer one is basically your physical, that's your actual wire. Layer two is the protocol on the wire, typically Ethernet. Three, we're talking about IP. On top of that's TCP. And then we jump up to six, which is probably application. Now, I want you to keep an eye on this because as I talk about various exploits, I'm probably going to work from the top down. What I'm going to do is point out, because everybody keeps saying, oh, what we're going to do is we're going to write a secure program. Well, so I break its foundation, the transport layer. Well, I'm going to write a secure transport layer. So I break the network layer. You go, well, we're going to use better IP authentication. Well, I'll just break your link layer. This is what's happened in security continuously, and that's what I'm going to try to point out in this talk while explaining things. But everybody understands this, right? Good. Now, one nice thing what TCP does is provides a connectionless, basically provides reliable connections over a connectionless protocol. As you know from his talk, it basically relies on three-way handshaking. I'm going over this again because it's important that you understand this part. It's ensured both sides agree that, hey, not only are we ready to talk, but we're going to talk. Like, for example, I go, hey, Punkus. He goes, hey, Pete. We've established a communication. I've called him. He acknowledges my, you know, my request to him, and we continue communication. That's exactly what three-way handshake is. So we have a client and server. I send a SYN packet. That's basically, you know, SYN equals X. That is acknowledged with an... So the acknowledgement is a SYN plus one, and it also establishes a sequence. Now, at this point, that second sequence acknowledged.
There's a point out here. Again, we send out this. Now, the sequence this direction is X. The sequence this direction is Y. Now that we understand that, this is how we establish it. Somebody asked me during the break, well, how do you, when you have randomized sequences, how do you know which sequence to use? Well, what is the starting sequence? That's the important part. Questions? Interrupt me anytime with a question. Okay, with three-way handshakes, basically, again, I'm reiterating this so you understand so you don't get lost in 5 minutes, that we now all agree that both sides are ready to exchange data and we have fun. Now, how do connections fail? That's actually kind of simple. We are on a client and server. I send a SYN. It sends a reset. It basically says, no thanks. Mind you, this is an oversimplified case, but in general, that's hopefully the way it's going to work. There. Unfortunately, IP stack is susceptible to tons and tons of, well, possible attacks, vulnerabilities, and spoofs. And that's what the remainder of this talk is about. If they have questions at all, please just interrupt. I mean, if I get ahead of you, just say so. Now, before we go on to attacks, we should talk about what kind of attacks exist. One frustration I see is like, oh, I've got a new exploit. It's a denial of service attack. Important thing is you need to classify your attacks. So in general, I find there's four types. The disclosure information, that's theft of information. You know, getting your info file, getting your credit report. There's destruction of data. You know, erasing your files. Alteration of data, changing your grades. Yeah. Well, yeah. So this again, well, disclosures, attacks against confidentiality of data, stealing it, exposing things, releasing Quake before it's ready. Password sniffers, email sniffers, this is all disclosure information. Destruction is wiping. Alteration is basically modification of data. It doesn't have to happen on disk. It can actually happen on a network. While you're logged into from a client to a server, for example, someone might insert data. That's alteration of data. And the most common is denial of service. These are all these script kiddies who think they're hackers because they could just flood your network. No, that is not a break-in. That's denial of service. That's the fourth type. Now, what types of DOS attacks exist? Well, we have ping flooding. Then there's modification, echo reply flooding. I'll explain these terms in the next slide or two. TCP looping, ping of death, SYN fragment overflow. I'm going to explain all these talks, I mean all these exploits to you. Ping flooding is the most simple one. That's when you just basically send lots and lots and lots of pings. Just run ping-f from a Unix shell, give it an IP host name, and the machine that you're on sends as many packets as possible to a remote site. Effectively allows the attacker to possibly inhibit network connectivity. Mind you, this is not going to work in your dial-up to my home T1. Yeah. It will work from my T1 to your dial-up. And those out here, the OC48, don't take out my T1. It's high bandwidth piece, low bandwidth. I have a friend who works at a large web development company, and they've got like several OC48s, and it's kind of humorous because people try to flood them out on IRC all the time. It's a waste of time. Okay, and another method is sending ping packets. You can basically send any kind of packet. But the ping program comes with Unix. There's, why write code where you just type ping-f? Well, if you really wanted to flood people out, you wouldn't use ping because routers are going to filter that. Now, how does it work? Simple. I'm sending packets to the internet. It's flooding your machine. No brainer. To be effective, again, I want to reinvent, you need greater bandwidth. I reiterate this because I don't know how many kiddies and their dial-ups try to flood my home T1. It just doesn't work. One common trick is if you're being flooded a lot, you will modify your firewall to say, for example, to block ICMP echo packets. Well, in that case, the person can start sending reply packets. If that doesn't work, they can literally start spawning you a whole bunch of, host unreachable packets, just random UDP packets. Now, My problem, bandwidth, that you have a small bandwidth, I have greater bandwidth. Well, how do we abuse this? Well, we can abuse other people's bandwidth. Now, as you know, ping is a simple program where you send out a packet and you get a reply back. Well, it comes back to you because you send it from your address. Here's the situation. There's my little notebook on the bottom. There's a bunch of badly set up machines on the right, and of course, a nice little victim that I want to take out. Now, a Smurf attack is simple. I send a single spoofed packet to that network. This is destined to a broadcast address. I don't know if that was covered, but when you transmit, we have IP addresses, you can transmit to a single host, and you can also transmit to all hosts on a network. If you're dumb enough to leave your gateway open to allow inbound broadcast address, you're going to have problems. And also, not only you have problems, but other people will have problems from you. So when the government starts calling you up on why you're flooding their network, somebody's probably using you as that group of hosts on the right. Now, I send one packet to that group of systems. What do all those hosts do? They reply. A lot. Now, again, I iterate. One packet? Many packets. This is the classic Smurf attack. Now, if I'm saying, so this is where your 14-4 modem can wipe out somebody's large net connection. Again, flood attacks are easy to do. You usually do it by filtering ICMP echo reply packets. The annoying part is you start filtering those, you can't ping people from your site. Other forms. Well, we have UDP echo spoofing. I'll explain this. You all know what UDP is now. Well, we have echo spoofing. There's a nice little port. There's a whole bunch of little ports called internal services that come with your Unix machines and NT machines, one of which is echo. You tell it to that port, and whatever you type gets typed back at you. If you send a UDP packet, it'll transmit the packet back to you. Kind of a ping-like thing, but it's a different layer of service. I don't know why it's there anymore. It's more of a legacy service. If any brains at all, you automatically turn this off. But we could have fun. Like, there's a little NT box over on the right-hand side. They installed all the network services, including UDP Echo. So, me being a nice person on the left, I send a UDP packet with a from address and to address of my victim. So where does my victim send the reply? Thus, what is that machine busy doing with all of its CPU time? Now, this can go on for quite a while. Eventually, CPU time maxes out, you drop a packet, and it goes away. Another method I could send from, I could use a source address of localhost, which is, again, kind of a unique host that always refers to yourself. And you send multiple packets. The machine keeps quite busy. Variations include transmitting to a broadcast address. We get a lot of machines broadcasting at each other and such. But it's kind of simple. There are patch versions of INetD. That's the daemon that spawns most of your internet network services under Unix. There are patch versions that will block these attacks, as in, I'm not talking to myself. Screw this. Ignore it. Yeah, that type of thing. IP filtering helps unprotected systems. You know, I hope you all have a firewall. Cyber, who flaked out in his early morning talk, will be rescheduled. He's going to drop his PKI talk, and he's going to talk about how to build a firewall out of BSD. That's going to be at 5 o'clock in this room. And if you do attend that talk, ask him where he was this morning. He was out shooting his guns instead of talking to you. So give him lots of hell for that. Now, SYN flooding. We all read the paper a few years ago. SYN flooding has actually been around for, I don't know, about 15 years. Although a couple years ago, Route actually released a public program, and all of a sudden, all the script kiddies can do it. And all the script kiddies think it's new technology. Read a paper from security paper 10 years ago. It's all talked about. In fact, all the attacks were talked about 15 years ago. Here we are. Basically, SYN flooding allows attacker to deny a system, attacks per port basis. You could read. Now, the way this simply works, again, we have my attacker system, non-existent, legitimate client. It used to be that most implementations of IP could only allow a certain number of starting connections. Now, they could have an infinite amount of current connections, but only a small amount of pending connections. So if you only allowed n pending connections, I could pick somebody and I go, hi. And this person says hi back to me, but I don't respond to that. Third person does it, fourth person does it. Now his buffer is full of pending inbound connections. And anybody else says hello to him, he won't respond because he's too busy waiting for acknowledgement from me and the other people. Do you understand at all? So I SYN flood that system. Now remember the three-way handshake. It sends all the acts into a black hole, a non-existent system. Now that victim system is waiting for the acknowledgement to its acts. Are they going to come? No, we have to time out first. So, since nobody can establish a new connection, a legitimate client cannot connect. Now, if you're logged into the victim system, everything's just fine and dandy. Your shell's working, you're typing away, and a machine's load is nothing, but nobody else can establish any new connections. It varies per host. It's usually, I believe, around 45 seconds, Puckus, the average. It pretty much varies a lot per host. There's a lot of software out there, actually. More advanced firewalls these days will detect this. And, you know, in the middle of attacker and victim system, an intelligent firewall or perhaps certain type of secure utilities will start transmitting the resets, causing all the acts to be reset. So. Destination host unreachable, it depends on your firewall. Some firewall types by default just say host unreachable for any packet they reject. Some firewalls don't reply anything. Other firewalls say network unreachable. It really depends on what product or whose security company you bought into. Hopefully the firewall that will reset will actually retransmit the connection. Again, it really depends on your product. I can't say what will one happen. In most of my examples here, we're assuming there's no firewall involved. And, of course, can't make the connection. And thus, remote access victim systems block. Takes very little bandwidth. You and your little dial-up or your ricochet modem can take out entire corporations this way. This assumes that you're running a old version of Solaris or Sonos. Any modern system basically released in the last year or two is resistant to this. Unless you run NT. Again, strong filtering helps. Send sniping. It's a fun one. Ever be on a network and want to shut people down? Well, this is how you do it. Here's that layout again. Here's that send packet again. Now remember how the three-way handshaking, remember how normally a connection fails? Now you'd assume the reset would come from the person receiving the connection, the server on the right. Instead, I fake the reset. The legitimate client doesn't know any better. SYN, reset, okay, port not open. Now when the ACK does come along, the legitimate client sees the SYN part of that and says, reset. Both machines did not establish TCP connection and there are no errors in your logs. Actually, if you're running a little program called ARPWatch, it's kind of fun because ARPWatch would notice that the spoofed reset came from a wrong MAC address, but that could be fooled also. Yes? These old machines are on the same physical wire, on the same unswitched dumb hub, and the attacker sniffed the packet and said, oh, here it is, reset. By the way, sequence number of the reset, 0. Your sequence number by default is 0 unless you've established the sequence. So in theory, the attacker can stream resets of sequence 0 at the legitimate client, and a connection can never be established. Again, the victim system can be selectively blocked. It requires, as I pointed out, local or intermediate network access. In other words, you have to be on one of the physical wires that this packet is traveling over to see the packets going back and forth. And it's pretty hard to detect because you could always spoof that. You could basically spoof your MAC address, spoof the IP address, obviously. It's kind of a bear to track down. Smart hubs help. Buy your Cisco Catalyst. Nice little VPN networks. Spoof protection. That'll help a lot. But then, of course, I'd rather buy a nice car than a decent, 5,500. What, a fully loaded Catalyst 5500 is like 110,000? Yeah. Security is expensive sometimes. Ping of death, we all know about this one. It's really simple. This is commonly implemented. It can be any type of IP packet, but it's commonly implemented as a ping. It implements a bug in layer 3. Now, in all protocols, or most packet protocols, there's this concept of maximum size packet. In ping of death, the error was we would allocate a packet size that's 65K, and then I would transmit a ping packet which was fragmented. When you reassembled all the parts of that packet, it was larger than the buffer. So you receive your first fragment, you write it to the buffer. You receive your second fragment, write it to the buffer. You receive your third, write it to the buffer. You receive your fourth, over the edge. And you'd overwrite parts of your system or kernel memory, a.k.a. blue screen of death. This worked on about every machine out there for a while. Again, this has been known for about a decade, only really came to public light about a year or two ago. Basic options, if you have a firewall you have control of, filter fragmented packets. There's no reason to allow a fragmented packet through your network. Well, you might say, why? Well, why should a packet be fragmented? If you have a healthy network going over a healthy internet into your healthy network, fragmentation should not happen. The only time fragmentation can possibly happen if you have a large packet network, for example, FTDI, retransmitted over Ethernet, which has smaller packets, at which point it will fragment. But if you configure your network to do that, you should suffer. Filter fragmented packets. I think on the average, if you run a website, you could lose up to 10% of, I think it's maximum 10% of the people trying to connect to you. Sometimes as low as 2%. far as I'm concerned, tough. They have a broken network. Now, permutations of this. Teardrop attack. So we have IP fragment flooding, that is microfragments overlapping. This is fun stuff. Overlapping fragments are fun. Effectively, Teardrop is a widely available tool. Anybody could download it. Root Shell, I kind of hate Root Shell for this because they have umpteen versions of Teardrop, yet they don't say what the Teardrop attack is. Wouldn't it be nice if all those hacker websites out there actually bothered to write even a paragraph to say what it is so I don't have to come up here and explain them to you? No, that might take effort. This is mostly Linux and NT. Basically, Linux and Windows are mostly vulnerable to this. Linux should be upgraded to perhaps FreeBSD. And if you want FreeBSD, we have free CDs in the conference area. Unlike Linux, FreeBSD is free. How much is Red Hat? They jack up the prices, actually. And by the way, they wouldn't make any available for free at DEF CON. And I'm not going to rank on them too much. I'll do that in a bar later. Okay, again, IP filtering helps. Generally what happens is you have a badly formed fragment. So you have one fragment comes in. You have a badly formed packet that comes in. When it tries to process the packet, the machine burps. In other words, it wasn't analyzing the fragments as it came in. Made the assumption that the offset in the packet was correct. It would, inside the packet in a fragment, you effectively, I kind of skipped out on Punks' talking up for breakfast, so in case he explains to you, I'm sorry. But effectively, in a packet, if you're fragmented, there's an offset reference. Well, if that offset reference doesn't match the content of the packet, your program might be tricked into doing something wrong and blowing up. Another fun thing, this is not in my slides, but one great way that you used to be able to take out Cisco routers about 8 years ago is in IP you have lots of variable options. And the way the header assembles is there's a byte offset to next option. And the way the computer works is, take current address, add option, add offset, and process current option. If you set that byte to zero, what does the machine do? Reprocess that option until the power goes out. On a single-threaded TCP/IP stack like Linux, you could really your machine really just comes to, just literally stops. If you're multi-threaded like any Solaris or BSD machine, it's not a problem. It'll just eat up a thread, which will eventually die. Again, fragment flooding is another fun one. When fragments come in, as you realize, you need to deal with these things. Sometimes fragments don't show up in order. So you're getting snippets of articles coming in, snippets of packets, and you've got to store them in memory somewhere until the other part comes up. You connect them together and then pass it on to the upper layer, to the application layer. What if I send lots and lots of random fragments to your machine? What happens to your RAM space? It fills up with useless garbage. NT, really vulnerable to this. Linux and the BSDs are actually fairly good about this. When they begin to run out of memory, they start just dumping the packets. Because if the packet, what happens is, if the packet wasn't properly acknowledged, it would be retransmitted, resent. It's not a problem. But there's a good way of eating up lots of CPU resources and run out of RAM real fast. In other words, microfragments. Let's make fragments so small you don't recognize what they are. So if I fragment, now mind you, we had Ethernet, IP, TCP. If you're filtering at the TCP layer, it's assumed you could read the entire TCP packet, with at least the header part. Well, what if I fragment my packet so small you can't read the header as a full part? Can you still filter? No. What do you do? Well, you probably pass it through. So what you do is you just fragment your packet so small, each one is not identified as a problem. Simple. Yes? A firewall policy of dropping all fragments would help a lot. Certain firewalls actually do reassembly. I believe the Cisco had a firewall that's basically discontinued. The NT-based one. Sentry was pretty good because the Sentry actually had a fragment packet policy that would reassemble fragments before passing them on. Actually pretty good. It was a bit memory intensive, but it worked. Most other firewalls will simply forward to fragments. The PICS firewalls option is only pass fragments when they come in order. So obviously the micro fragments may or may not work. Actually, I think it just drops those. The overlapping fragments and the fragment flooding would not work because it only allows fragments in order. Mind you, this breaks Linux because when Linux fragments, it breaks a packet maybe three parts. It sends the last part first and the first part last. So the PICS firewall simply drops the packet because it gets fragments, four, then three, then two, then one. When it gets packet four, it goes, where's 3, 2, 1? Ditch it, because this is a random fragment. I don't know if that's a bug in Linux or a bug in PICS, but oh well. Questions? Okay, other fun things. You all heard about sniffing? Yeah, get your password stolen? ARP cache poisoning is a fun one. Now, mind you, so far, if not, I've worked my way down that protocol stack. Every time I explain a fix, I'm going to break it again in about 5 minutes. Now, sniffing's a fun one. Don't you love that little number on the bottom? 85% to 95% of attacks. I love these kids that call themselves hackers because they break into one ISP, steal passwords, break into another ISP, steal passwords. When are they actually showing technique? Now, sniffing is easy for the person who hasn't figured it out yet. It's simply an intersection of data. As client sends a server, my notebook sitting on your machine has your password. Anybody use any of these applications or protocols? Hands? Come on. Your password has been stolen. Telnet, clear text, unencrypted. Rlogin, clear text, unencrypted. Well, POP, IMAP, clear text. APOP is kind of, if you're using APOP, okay, then you're a little bit safer. I can only read your mail. I can't read your password. HTTP. When a little dialog box pops up, you type your name and password, clear text. FTP, clear text. Simple mail transfer, clear text. Simple network management, clear text. RPC, NFS, clear text. All of which are available to be listened to over your network. Feel secure? Ever use SSH? SSL will provide encryption. Although one minor plug again or four against SSL. SSL simply means the person cannot listen to your packets between you and the server. It does not mean the server is secure. One of my pet peeves, like, we're secure, we use SSL. That doesn't mean they're secure. It means that the data getting to them is encrypted. The second is handed off to their applications as clear text. Listen again, just name a few. Be aware. Download SSH, download secure CRT, use it. If your ISP doesn't support it, tell them to. If they don't, get a new ISP. Best protection? Buy a smart hub. I know, it's kind of expensive, but you got to do it if you're going to be serious. Use SSH, use Kerberos, that's kind of nice. There's DES Telnet, but it's not really widely distributed as it should be. Whenever possible, remove promiscuous mode. On my home site, you can't sniff. I've rebuilt all my kernels, and I removed the capability from sniffing from my kernels. Go ahead, root my system. People do all the time. You can't sniff. It makes your network a little bit more secure. Well, to rebuild the kernel would be kind of nice, but you got to replace the kernel. But because it's an immutable file, you need to reboot the machine from console and install it, which is kind of a pain in the ass because I have to be there at console to install it. Maybe if I cow lots of beer, I'll sneak in the war room and do it for me, but I don't know. Let's see, but on local Ethernets, it's common MAC address poisoning. I love this. Remember I told you about all the different ways about TCP/IP and how you can fool things and redirect things? Well, let's go one layer. Let's go to, like, layer two. Ethernet level. Press anybody to impersonate anybody on your local LAN. I love it. We have now secure IP coming out. We're doing all the secure stuff with IP. We're encrypting our packets and everything else. Well, too bad. I just blew your foundation away. A lot of denial of services, a lot of redirects. Now, how does ARP cache work? Well, you're on a network. Every network, every Ethernet card has, in theory, a unique MAC address. And also you have a lot of unique IP addresses. Hopefully it's a unique IP address. So how do the machines figure out who's who? Well, something called ARPs. So host 3.4 does a transmit. Hey, who's 3.8? That's a broadcast over the local Ethernet. That machine replies, hey, that's me. Oh, for your notification, that's a MAC address number. The first several bytes are, you can pretty much tell what kind of host I'm working with here by looking at the first several bytes. I'll leave that to your own figuring out what kind of machine I have at home. And a second set of bytes are the host type. But by just looking at the MAC address, you can tell the hardware type. So, in the case of a break-in, what happens? Here we are with that little transmission. Hey, who is this person? I lie. Where do the IP packets go? Straight down. Oh, by the way, Loft will be announcing a product this weekend. If you're interested in this stuff, look for their announcement. So, ARP cache poisoning. Buy a smart switch, buy a smart hub. Oh, one more quick thing about this. You don't have to wait for the request. A lot of applications will just accept a packet. If you just get on a network saying, hi, I'm the new router here, I'm this main routing address. A lot of machines is like, oh, okay, update the cache, it'll start sending information to you. And of course, I don't believe in handout things on handout fixes. Again, mortgage the house, buy a smart hub or a switch. Yeah. Whenever possible, remove promiscuous mode from your kernel. It's like a broken record. Run network ARP watch is really good. ARP watch is a program that a friend of mine wrote. It basically listens to your network and keeps a table of IP addresses to Ethernet addresses. When a new one shows up, it sends a notification, hey, new IP address, or hey, new MAC address. If somebody uses somebody else's IP address, it goes, hey, map changed. So if I plug this my notebook into your network and start trying to take over your connectivity or take over your identity, what happens? At least you'll know about it. It's really good for people running large sites when you have employees bringing new computers in or moving computers around the network. Catches them real fast. On stable networks, in other words, places that aren't being re-IP addressed all the time, go to your servers, preferably Unix. You can also do this on NT. I'll let you figure out where that menu is by yourself. And you can permanently insert into an ARP table. And that's the command ARP-S, IP address, MAC address, and pub. And that'll permanently insert that MAC address into your kernel table, which means it'll ignore the broadcasts. If you have your mail server, your DNS server, all your different servers, I hope you're not running on the same machine. That's another foolish thing to do, but that's a different talk. I hope each of your major network services runs on dedicated individual hardware. And I hope when you get home that you go in, you hard code your MAC addresses between servers. This way, no one can spoof. Mind you, when a machine crashes and you replace the Ethernet card, life will be bad. You have to go to every fucking machine and reprogram and redo your ARP table. But, good luck. And this doesn't quite work with transit networks, DHCP-based stuff. Yes and no. Most newer cards actually have their MAC addresses changed, usually the programming. By default, the MAC address is assigned to the card, unless you use Sparks, which points out it's bound to the CPU. So it's kind of a pain, yeah. So if you put two Ethernet cards into the same Spark station, they both have the same MAC address, and if you connect them both to the same Ethernet for some various reason, things will get broken real fast. But rule of thumb, it's bound directly to the card. In fact, let's see.
There are exceptions.
Yeah, there are many exceptions, but as rule of thumb. I mean, you look at your Ethernet card, and on the back it says EA, and then my Ethernet address. Happens to be the same one in the slide. But it's bound into your card. Now, sequence prediction. You thought you had SSH? Well, actually, this won't break SSH. It'll just make your life a little bit more annoying. But this is a good way of trashing your telnet connections. Talk to Route. Route will be happy to point you to the FRAC article that gave you the program to do this, no problem. Now, again, we have a bunch of hosts. And let's say I take out trusted hosts. So, SynFlood, bye-bye. Yeah. Could be ping of death. Can be, the latest application. Don't worry about that. But, okay, that machine is out. Next. I go, Hi, Target. Hi, Pete. Now, let's call that sequence one. Let's say call it, the sequence number I got to say would be 10. Next one I got is 12. 14. What's the next one going to be? 16. So what do? I send a spoofed packet. It replies to me as the 16. Using that number, I can reply, even though I never saw the acknowledged sequence number. Again, there you go. Yeah. We connect up. We send a few packets. We figure out what the sequence is. We find it's very predictable. Most new machines now randomize a starting sequence. But before, it was like clockwork. You ran R-Bone. It was one program. It was great. Because it goes, current sequence, guess sequence, real sequence. And you just watch the numbers converge. And then once the numbers converge, the program just, you're root. It was really fun because you have these numbers streaming up your screen and converging. And as when the delta hits zero, boom, you're in. It's like in the movies. So, I love watching hacker movies because these hackers put more time into the GUIs of the application. I wish I could download shit like that from other people. But back here we send the spoofs in. It sends it to sends it to the trusted host. By the way, by default, you would think the trusted host would have sent a reset. But it's down. Can't send a reset. Which allows me to, mind you only get one packet. That's one of the problems. But that packet can be reboot. RM star. Send me a next term. Our host, defcon.org. Whatever you want it to be. All you need is one command. Follow? Questions? Now, let's see. Again, this is just an explanation. I was going to print out the slides, but it's too early in the morning. Go to Kinko's and print them. These slides will probably be available on the DEF CON webpage. DT always seems to publish these things. But this is just an explanation of what I just said. OS is now randomizer numbers. Makes it a little bit harder to do. It turns out that some of the randomizations were very weak. So, even though it looked random, it wasn't random. Whoops. Crypto login helps a lot. Because under crypto login, after you establish a three-way handshake, we need to still do the encrypted, especially SSH example, we still need to perform the key exchange. So it's more than one packet. Yes?
In Slurs 2.6, there's two or three different options for randomizing your sequence numbers. Mm-hmm. There's one for standard stuff, which I think doesn't really randomize it. And there's one for RFC.
Somebody wrote it. RFCs are basically internet documents that propose standards.
And then there's one other one for randomizing the sequence. Do you recommend, about those?
I'm familiar with the different propositions. I recommend using the RFC or the randomized one, not the non-randomized one. It's up to you. I imagine that the RFC is a standard and the other one's a homebrew. If your network works, don't worry about it. And here we are, session hijacking. This is very similar to what I just did. Here's that slide again. Now, I'll save you the effort of seeing the three-way handshake. Let's just say it happened. You were happily logged into your ISP. You're on IRC. Telnet it in. Whatever else. And what happens? I spoof a packet. I hijack a session. I know what your sequences are. I jump into the conversation midstream. We exchange a packet or two. All of a sudden, your trusted host is out of sequence, so it's going to be ignored. And I now have your telnet connection. The timing's tricky. That's why you use software. Now, once I send that, I get sent lots. Now, problem is you're going to have an axe storm. Because your target host is not going to get acknowledgement for a packet it sent. And it's going to start streaming axe at each other. Same thing for the trusted host. And eventually your connection will drop because it's going to discover the axe zone associated with that TCP, and your kernel's going to go, something screwy here, kill a connection. Now, a partial hack might be to send an ARP to the target host and make it send its axe to Never Never Land. That would be a pretty good one. That helps a little bit. So, quick explanation. I desynchronize the connection, then I jump into the sequence that I established,
and you're typing along, all of a sudden your screen doesn't respond anymore, and I've got the session on my notebook. The software is published in FRAC. Anybody going to use Telnet again? Anybody here used Telnet before and not again? And again, workers to house, buy decent networking equipment. Port scans, we all know about them yet? Yeah, I'm going to go over them quickly because that's actually what the next talk's about. DNS cache poisoning is a fun one. Did you notice that DEF CON web page was down for a few weeks ago? DNS cache poisoning. So port scanning is kind of easy. I'll kind of skip through this quickly because this is actually what the next talk's about. Basically, I send a port to connection 1, I get a reset, it's closed. 2, reset. Port 3, reset, skip to 7. Open! Echo port's open, port 7. Discard was open, 11 was closed, 20, FTP was open. This is basically what happens when we run strobe or nmap. When you run strobe or nmap. That's the next talk. And I'm going to skip through this. I don't want to really tread all over modify. And there's different types of options. I'm going to skip through this because, again, I don't want to take the wind out of somebody's sails. Let's see what we're doing. We're doing fine on time. And you basically, by the way, you don't know what to do resets. I'll skip through this again. I don't want to take the wind out. You can spot this stuff. Here's a few applications, TCP log, netstat, abacus. Those are little applications you can run on your server. Again, I'm skipping these slides. It's all next hour. That's the fun stuff. DNS cache poisoning. Everybody know about DNS or how it works? I'll tell you. Okay, here with the .dot server, the .com server, and the acme.com server. And, of course, legitimate client and DNS server. Now, this is a normal, healthy situation. Your client goes to your local DNS server, goes, hey, where's acme.com? We send a packet off to the root of all internet called .dot. It goes, hey, who's acme.com? I don't know. Why don't you ask .com? Hey, who's acme.com? I don't know. Why don't you ask acme? Hey, who is this person? Oh, the answer is, and it gets sent up with the proper IP address. Simple, huh? Now, it might seem inefficient, but actually what happens is your DNS server down here caches that information. So next time somebody asks, it's already in the cache. A little bit more efficient that way. Also causes some minor security problems. Vulnerabilities to cache, you always insert erroneous information. Like, where did that reply actually come from? Here we are again. As an outside person, I go, hey, who's acme.com? It goes, where is that? I reply. It sends me the answer. That's obviously the wrong address. Gee, could that be the same IP address that www.defcon.org had maybe 3 weeks ago? I had nothing to do with that. So what happens later on? Somebody else asks for it. You get that reply. Okay, what if we were talking Wells Fargo Bank? And that IP address was my home web server. What would happen when I ask for your password? You type it in. And what happens when I ask you about your account number? You type it in. Then what happens? I go to jail. Have to pay for my DEF CON trip. But again, if you update the current versions, 8 dot something by Paul Vixie, I recommend that. For the person who knows what I was talking about, yes, I know there's several permutations to this. It used to be in this whole little mess, they started doing it. It used to be that DNS servers would only accept, responses. It would just accept a response. It wouldn't even care if it asked a question or just accept it. Well, they go, let's fix that. So now it only accepted responses for questions asked. Well, eventually we realize, we just asked a question first. So the DNS server goes, fine, we'll start sequencing our requests and making sure the answer is the same sequence. That didn't work. The sequences are A, very predictable. B, you're able to send all the possible sequences within a minute anyway, so. I mean, all the sequences, if your sequence is only, how long does it take to send like 65,000 packets? Not long. And so they took care of that. So now they theoretically randomize the sequence, but it turns out the sequence randomization is not that random. You know, so it's a little thing going here, but run the latest version, it's a lot better. And next version, we're actually going to have encryption. That'll help a lot.
Peter,
yes?
Does this only work if the existing IP address is not in the DNS cache?
Yes and no. In this case, we're assuming you're actually going to ask it. Yes, it will ask it, but a lot of times we'll send a packet, it'll at least send a packet out asking for what's the current version of IP address, called the SOA record, which is a serial number. And if I reply with a higher serial number, I could override it. So when I send that little fake packet, it's going to have a serial number of 9,999,000,000, just, you know, some astronomical number, and with an expiration date will never time out. So that's going to be in your cache to power down your server. And eventually, yes, if it's already in your cache, I might not get it in, but then it's all I got to do is ask for another record that's not in your cache, and I could probably slip it in. One of the other exploits, of course, was piggybacking. You know, I run disorg. That's my home domain IP, you know, home domain. And I would, for example, get you to do a disorg lookup, and then my disorg reply piggyback a Wells Fargo reply. That was another way of slipping past the gates. You know, again, I could quite literally go on for an hour of just permutations of this one. So in closing for this particular topic, we'll just say upgrade. Even if you just installed Solaris 7, upgrade. Whenever you buy a commercial product, download, install. Same thing with SendMail. So effectively, upgrade, fixed pending, you know, modern version tracks queries, etc. BGP, anybody know what that is? Yes. This is a fun one. You all heard about, killing the internet in 20 minutes? Want to know how to do it?
Yeah.
Actually, disorg is actually released some automated scripts for this one. Okay, here's a little network. We have an internal router. We have a couple peers. Obviously, these people got money since they have multiple connections to the internet. Internal router establishes a BGP connection to the peer routers, the little blue arrows. I'm on the outside world. B, being a nasty sob, forges reset and fin packets. Mind you, these are TCP connections. I don't know what the sequence is. But there's only 65,000 of them. How long is it going to take me? Now, eventually, that network goes out. When internal router and router A discover a drop of TCP connection, internal and A assume the other guy crashed, automatically rebalance their internal balance tree of routes. And if you're anywhere near a large hub or large center of the universe, that can take a long time and a lot of memory. And after it balances this, it reestablishes connection and then rebalances the tree. After the tree is balanced, then your connectivity. So your network can be down for up to 20 minutes. This is an extreme case, but it takes a while. So a peer loses BGP connection, you're screwed. You no longer have connectivity through that one peer. This is a blind attack. I have a 1 in 65,000 chance. Not a problem. Better than the lottery, better than the slot machine. Let's see, attacker may be able to keep the connection down infinitely by continuously resetting resets to zero. Again, what's the first sequence number? Zero. Until we establish a sequence, it's assumed to be zero. So when you send out the SYN, the reset is sequence zero since we haven't really established a full sequence. The attacker may keep things down, and eventually, with routing tables large enough, it can take sequence time to come back up. So your network is up, 3 minutes every 10 minutes or worse? Your site's out of luck. You can really embargo a corporation this way. And the network admins will go nuts because the routers are up, the routers are pinging each other. Your Cisco Discovery Protocol says, yep, I see a router right next to me, and you get the connection, and it goes right back down, and they'll be pulling their hair out all day to hook up a proper network monitor. And again, this attack is best fixed by filters. Unfortunately, if I get to pick on Cisco, it's more actually most networks, you lose about 40% of your bandwidth when you turn on IP filtering.
So since people only buy a big enough router that they need, nothing more, they discover they turn on IP filtering, their router isn't big enough, but they just pay, they spend how much money? So it's a problem. Question?
Yeah, how traceable back to you?
Well, since I'm probably spoofing, it's going to take a while. You'll probably have to manually do it. You really just can't say where's the packet came from because the source address has the wrong stamp on it. You probably have to call up each person in your chain of connections, hopefully not 255 hops, usually about 30, and get them to run a monitor and tell you where the packet's coming from.
How often do they get calls asking to do that?
I don't know. I don't work there. It really depends. A lot of them want a subpoena first. It's a whole privacy versus workability issue. That falls into Jennifer's, I guess, column. But this is a fun one. This one is really, it's way too much fun. They go, we have IP filters, so bam. Again, you know, the internet's getting overloaded. The centralized hubs just don't have enough bandwidth to support filtering. Most companies, the best thing you can do is if you run a company, you run an ISP, filter your outbound. There's no reason a packet should leave your network if it's not from your network. That being, have an outbound filter, that means that all packets leaving your net have a source address of your network. And this will stop people using your network from abusing other people. That'll help a lot. In closing, I want to jump up on the protocol stack a little bit and talk about simple network management protocol. We all know about this. This sucker is fun. I recommend download the public domain packages and play with it. See, everybody says they're keeping it a little secret. They close finger. They close all this information. Well, there's these wonderful RFCs you could look up. What can you do? Well, a lot more and more applications are SNMP available. Soon it's going to be LDAP. And I've turned off UPSs at ISPs. Yeah, after the PO order cleared, it was legal. But it's great. They're like, we're fine. We're vulnerable. So I did a trend. I noticed they had smart UPSs that actually had SNMP available. I says, UPSs, low power mode. And they go, okay. and it had four-letter words for me, but yeah. He was bragging, I can't get root on his system. Well, I can also take his system down. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. He said he knows the ISP that monitors the traffic of other ISPs. Yeah, you connect to your router. You go, hey, your router, tell me about your packet flow, tell me about your network bandwidth, and tell me about your resets. And, all these things are available. There's lots of fun little programs out there. They'll pop graphs up all over your X-Window screen of what's your bandwidth, how many resets, what type of packets, sometimes even as detailed as what type of packets there are, as in web versus mail. That's some more advanced stuff. Odds are you're not going to get that. But we'll tell you how many IP versus UDP versus unknown versus fragmented versus bandwidth usage versus time. Just boom, right there. And you could point at other people. You could talk to a hub in a second. You could talk to a hub and go, hub, what hosts are there? And you get a list of MAC addresses. And because I get your MAC address, I know that's a Sun station, MAC station, probably a Linux machine, MAC station, PC, Spark station. I know what machines are on what port. And I go, oh, look, that's a Spark server. Turn that port off. A little yellow on your, on your little catalyst or whatever thing you're using goes from green to yellow. It's shut down. Sorry. And by the way, that syslog machine, your IDS system, is now no longer receiving anything. All available over the internet. I used to have a boss that made me show up for work because I telecommuted too much. He'd turn off the port on my workstation, so I had to show up and turn it back on. Yes? But you really have, why break into a site when it tells you everything? Certain Ascend routers, you can upload new configurations into the dial-up server through SNMP. Now, SNMP has two types. There's public and there's private. Public is, just statistics. Private is for configuration. The default attribute is the word public and the word private. Connect up using the word private, and I'd say 75% of machines you own. Don't you love this? Version, by the way, and also everything's in clear text. Version 2 actually fixes this a little bit.
here's some things I've actually done to people. Turn off UPSs, like find your version number. I could download your packet filters, find out how to organize my packets to get through. Reconfigure your site. I could actually get, literally, you have graphic maps. Nice printable maps of your network topology. What hosts run, what subnet, what kind of routers, everything. Traffic monitoring, redirection. UDP, easy to sniff, easy to spoof, clear text passwords. Now, what do I recommend? Get version 2. It's actually a little bit encrypted. Mortgage a house, buy a switching hub. Use IP filtering. And change your default password away from public and private. Yeah?
If they only support SMB version 1, would you suggest you just turn off the
name? Yes. References? Loft, Root Shell, even though I hate Root Shell. I guess that's old. Second doesn't exist anymore, really. They got bought. Got to fix my slides. And also Geek, the archive moved away from Geek Girl, but these will point you in the right direction anyway. Questions? Yes? Okay. I kind of knew this. I just hadn't updated that slide. Yeah? No, you're probably. Odds are your switching hub is not really a switching hub. You have a bank switch hub. Is it 10/100? Is it dual? Usually when you. Okay, chances are that, quote, switching hub is actually your switch between your ether to your 10. I've got a 12-port 10/100, and I have MAC address filtering between the bank of between the 100 megabit and the 10 megabit. Sometimes you could hack those hubs by spewing lots and lots and lots and lots of MAC addresses at it, and when it runs out of memory and it doesn't know what port a certain MAC address is, it does a broadcast. Yes? I don't even know the good hubs. Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
We have an advertiser for TerraTerm over here. I get all my SSHs for free anyway. They kind of like me. Questions? We're almost out of time, so lots of questions as Modify comes up. Yes? I can't hear you. If it's using encryption, it should at least be a little bit better than not using encryption. One of my frustrations, for example, is Netscape. You have a choice of SSL or nothing. It's one of you. Yes. DOC table. Next up is scanning, all the stuff I skip. We'll get started in about 5 minutes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.